I've heard about him.
I'll call the January 22nd, 2007 meeting of the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development to session and open an informational meeting on that topic. Our first panel from the Workforce Investment Board talking about workforce strategies includes Elizabeth King, Chair. Thank you very much for coming. And Jerry Fletcher from the IBEW.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to both of you. Thank you very much for getting up and joining us first thing this morning. And if you would both please introduce yourselves for the record before you begin. And I don't know who's going first, but we'll leave that up to you two.
I'm Chair Witt and Vice Chair Lemon, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth King. I'm Chair of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and I am at work at ESCO Corporation in Portland, Oregon. ESCO is a steel manufacturing company. It's been in Portland since 1913. I have never not worked for them all those years. But they have, we have about 3,600 employees and a worldwide company. And first of all, thank you so much for taking the time to hear our work today. We're really appreciative of that. We want to talk a little bit about our Oregon Workforce Investment Board and the strategic plan that we developed with the governor to build a globally competitive workforce. And I understand that you already had a meeting with Lita and some of our cohorts in regards to some of our work, so we'll be just simply adding to maybe what's already been presented to you. Today we want to focus really on two different things. The first one is how the board plans to implement that strategic plan and turn that plan into action. And secondly, to invite you to partner with us.
Elizabeth, if I could interrupt just for a minute. Excuse me. For the benefit of the folks who may be listening over the Internet and not familiar with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, could you give the 20-second Reader's Digest version of what OWIB is, please?
Perfect.
Thank you.
The Oregon Workforce Investment Board is a 25-member business and labor-led workforce advisory board to the governor. We guide the workforce system of services with and through seven local workforce investment boards and then multiple state agencies and our industry partners throughout the region. We serve over 200,000 people annually and help them find jobs, assess their skill sets, and refer them to training. So we're intimately engaged with workforce development throughout the state, again, appointed by and directed by the governor. Our work also includes making policies. We don't do all the work, but again, we lead and direct that work so that it's coordinated. And given the work with the governor gave us a task in 2003 to do three different things. The first one of those things was to connect the workforce system to the economic cluster strategy and industry needs. And the second thing was to direct the workforce investments to strategic opportunities. And then, of course, as you could imagine the governor saying, streamline your systems and make it easier to use. So those were the three things that we were tasked with. Based on that direction, the Workforce Board decided to focus its efforts on the key economic sectors that have high wage job opportunities, yet face shortages of workers. And specifically, the areas that we focused on were healthcare and manufacturing. So as a result of a host of number of activities, I would highlight just two of those. One is we established the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, and that was to coordinate a statewide response to healthcare workforce shortages. And you have a sheet that is, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board will draw reference to it, but a host of activities are listed on there. The second that I would highlight is our manufacturing strategy, and you'll be hearing from the folks who've been working specifically on that. Shortly, they're in the audience here. This is a statewide plan to raise awareness about the importance of jobs in manufacturing and build a skilled labor pool for that sector of the market. And then, of course, we also worked collaboratively with local workforce investment boards from each of your regions so that we would focus on the needs of specific those areas. So that was a brief look back, but our current charge is really about directing the future. And the governor asked us to for a plan to build a globally competitive workforce. So literally, we convene hundreds of people around the state. We pull them together in focus groups to say, what is it that you need? What does it look like? Where do we go from here? So we worked with the local workforce investment boards to do that, state agencies, business, labor, education, and workforce partners. So what we wanted to do was create a plan that addressed the needs of the entire state of workers. Well, what we learned was that in all over Oregon, we're facing similar challenges. We truly live in a competitive environment. That race is with the rest of the world to stay ahead. All over the state, we heard that same message. We all want to prosper. We all want to grow good jobs. We all want to live in a good economy. And we all want Oregonians to live a good quality life. However, it was clear to us that in order to do that, we needed to find our competitive advantage. It is our strong belief that competitive advantage is our people. It's a workforce with the knowledge and the skills that not only keeps our current workers working in living wage jobs, but also attracts new businesses to our state. So in addition to the strategy, the Workforce Board has developed an action plan. And again, you have a list of that, many of those activities in front of you. And the purpose was to set our priorities and to begin implementation of the governor's vision. We will continue to direct discretionary funds, federal funds, to initiate the system changes and priorities outlined in our action plan. We see ourselves as leaders of that group. We will not do all the work. But with our local workforce investment boards, we will mobilize businesses, workers, students, teachers, parents, elected leaders, because we all can work together on this project. I'm going to turn it over to my fellow board member, Jerry Fletcher, to provide you with a brief overview of our action plan and some of our priorities. But I have two requests. One, please understand that the board, agencies, and partners, the work that we've put together in our strategy plan, is we are committed to having the most effective, responsive system with the resources we have. But we cannot do this work on a new economy with the federal resources alone. The federal funds are diminishing, and they are not programmed to address what we see as global competitive needs. Second, we want you to use our Oregon Workforce Investment Board. We are a group of people who are committed to workforce development. We have put in time. We have listened to our advocates. And over the course of the next 6 months, you will hear from many of those people that we've worked with about how to improve the system, how to address those specific programs and issues. We trust that you will call on us to use the strategic plan as our direction for the state, because it represents the work of many of those committed people working toward that common vision. So please use us as a connection to the business and the labor markets. We've worked hard to represent the voice of the people. We look forward to partnering with you and in moving forward on the initiatives that truly will make us a winner in the global market. Jerry?
Thank you, Elizabeth. Vice Chair Witt, Vice Chair Riley, and Vice Chair Lim, good morning. I'm Jerry Fletcher, a labor representative for the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and I'm very honored to be in front of you. I'm an electrician by trade. In fact, tomorrow I'll be hooking up lights and receptacles. And on this vision that we have for the board, we really do need your help. As you well know, we've lost a lot of work overseas. Freightliner shutting down this week, and we've got to train these people that are coming into the workforce. Nothing hurts anybody worse than somebody with a resume to die for. The guy's never been late, never missed any time. He's 50 years old, and he's got nowhere to go. And we've got to help those people. The Skill Up Oregon that the governor's plan has is a step in that right direction. I'm not saying it's the total answer, but it's something we have to do. We're losing work overseas. It's hurting us. And I'm sure you're feeling it as well. So we're asking you to give us a hand on this. Our board is targeting resources to critical problems or issues to reach the goals in our plan. We will measure outcomes and adjust our approaches as we evaluate what works. Once we identify effective practices, we will need your help to expand those effective solutions statewide. We've got a very, very good board, 25-member board, and labor management has been the key to that. We have businesses listening to the workers, workers listening to management, which is something pretty unique. As a labor representative who negotiates contracts, I was a little bit apprehensive to be on this board, to be honest with you. I can honestly say I've never worked with finer people like Elizabeth King, Carl Califano of Wachang. These people really do care about Oregon. And we need these people. We need to support them. This bill, that House Bill 2206, that the governor has put in front of you, and we'll ask for your support, is critical for that next step there. We need your help. What I bring to the table on this board, apprenticeship training, drug awareness, and career and technical training. I can actually speak with those with authority. I think I know what I'm talking about on those. And this bill will address those issues. So, again, we ask for your support on this priorities for Oregon. We really do need it. We have a long ways to go, but this is the first step in the right direction. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much. Questions or comments from the committee?
I have a question.
Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the testimony. Could you explain to me what's the difference is workforce and workforces?
Workforce would be all of our folks and individuals who come together to do the work that any of us do, regardless of the category that we're in. WorkSource Oregon is the name that we have ascribed to the whole system of people coming to work or learning to work in the state of Oregon. So it includes our community colleges. It includes our Oregon Workforce Investment Board. It includes all of our organizations that make up WorkSource. It's our local investment boards. It's the system that supports the workers in the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Other committee members, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question for anybody who wants to answer it, I suppose. But, one of the things that's been brought to my attention by actually some businesses, sometimes they get concerned about some of the workforce dollars and exactly whether they're going to provide training for one of our targeted industry clusters, or are they just particular subsidies to an individual business which gives them somewhat of an advantage competing against their competitors? And so I'm wondering, how it seems like we have the Department of Economic Development that's really talking about training and workforce training and in our targeted industry clusters, and then we have the community college system that handles workforce development, and then the workforce investment boards. And so it seems like we've got three different agencies all trying to do the same thing with really nobody, except perhaps in the governor's office, saying, this is what we need to do. And so they have somewhat different missions, and I know that workforce development used to be under the Department of Economic Development, and I'm just wondering whether you see really competing agencies on this, or is there enough collaboration that everybody's on the same page and we're going the same direction, or are we just outgoing, different directions with really not much focus on our clusters and our industries, that when we train, we're training for the industry and not really specific employers?
If I didn't know better, I'd say you were probably talking to the governor who charged us with saying, hey, get on the same page. And so that's what you see in this Oregon strategic, this plan, the winning in the global market. That is our plan, to get everyone on the same page and moving in the same direction. And we do work closely with the Oregon economic folks in moving forward. In fact, we've done some presentations to them. And in response to your question, are we targeting the right markets? We really have very carefully looked at the numbers in the state of Oregon and said, where are we short on workers? And really, we came up with those two areas, well, many different areas, but the two that we felt like we needed to focus on immediately were healthcare and the manufacturing industry. I can speak personally from our work at ESCO Corporation because we have taken advantage of and used some of those dollars for creating material and scaling up some of our employees at ESCO. So would it make us more competitive than another company? Well, we would like to believe that it would, but are we in competition with other people? Any of the material that we've created at ESCO Corporation that is created through any of the grant dollars that we received is available to any company and any buddy in our state, any educational system. We work collaboratively with the community college system to create that material, and many of those campuses are now using the same material we use within our company because we created it together. So hopefully what we're doing is have made huge strides in being collaborative in that work and moving in the same direction. So I would hope to believe that the story that you've just told about different agencies working in different directions would be an old story.
Representative Holby, if I can just interject to also with Elizabeth's comments, nobody takes a more sinister look at what problem is by throwing money at it. And I do agree with you, you're going to have competing agencies for that money. The state of Oregon takes in close to $60 million a year in federal funds, and they disperse that to different entities. And, of course, there's always going to be that fight. Our job as the OWIP is to stop that. And as a labor representative, I look at corporate welfare or anything like that very, very, I have a dim view of it, I'll put it that way. And it's our job now to stop that, to make sure that that money gets to that worker and not to some administrative bureaucracy, because I really don't appreciate it. Well, these people need to be trained.
One more question.
Representative Dahl.
For either one of you, when we look at the Workforce Investment Board, and we use the term dollars, how many dollars do you have to direct or to target various problems? What's your budget?
Roughly $60 million comes in to the Oregon system through a Workforce Investment Act, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. You have Carl Perkins Act. There's six big ones, the big six I call them, and I don't exactly have all the answers. Now, Lita Collagen of the state office can give you more of a detailed answer, but it's sizable, Representative Dahlem. It's a lot of money there.
Lita, would you come up, please? You may have some additional information on this. Good morning. Welcome back to the committee once again. Please introduce yourself, and if you could also respond to the last question.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. Multiple agencies in the state receive federal dollars for workforce training, and so we often say, how big is the bread box? Where do you want to draw the line? But for me, when I look at it as a member of the board also, I consider our federal dollars coming in for this around $200 million. And that includes, though, let me kind of reiterate what that is. The money that Jerry's been talking about is more of our Title I-B. Those are dollars that are received, and it's really more like $55 million, something like that, that come into the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. It's a pass-through. You heard Cam Price-Brawley talking last week about being a pass-through agency. We receive those, but we pass those dollars to the local workforce investment boards in your regions, and then they contract for services with them. But in the $200 million, besides that, we also have the employment department that's almost exclusively funded with federal dollars. And those are and you heard Lori Warner talking about those services, those are the job matching services. They operate the unemployment insurance programs. They operate the WorkSource Oregon centers and match people to jobs. And it also includes programs in Department of Human Services to help people who are on public assistance get to work. So it's a broad and very diverse system. And wait, 1 second, excuse me. To answer the question, though, how many discretionary dollars does the board have? They actually look at performance for the whole system. Okay, and those are federal performance measures. But the governor in 2003, by executive order, redirected about $6 million of the Title I-B money annually for the board to make these strategic investments and tie their investments to clusters and to our economic strategy. And that's the money that many of you have been hearing about and have referred to. It's the money we're using to look at apprenticeship, career, and technical education, to make grants to companies, to tie it to our cluster strategy, to do the healthcare and manufacturing work that we've been targeting.
And thank you, Lita. And could you, just for the record, identify your office, please?
Excuse me. Lita Colligan with the Governor's Office. I'm the Workforce Policy Advisor for Governor Kulongoski and a member of the Workforce Board.
Thank you very much. Follow-up, Representative Dahl?
Thank you very much, Chair Witt. Yes, I'm looking at the back of issue, the plan. And I see that targeted healthcare investments, and we have $200 million or $60 million. Where would I see that? And I want to go. Let me give you a notion. The last time we met, in fact, when I was so excited about job placement, I went with a person who went all through the system. Where would I find a person in House District 59, the Dalles, Madras, or John Day, that is the recipient of some of this training, and where could I sit with them and see what they're learning?
Right now we have what they call a wind turbine technician training program for the windmills there in Wasco and Sherman County. That's one of the new ones we're starting up right now, because with the wind turbines, that's a whole different strategy. Usually what happens is the vendor will send them out from Netherlands, France, or whatever, and they will sit and they will actually do the work. Now we're actually taking that work away from them and doing the maintenance calibration, any kind of repair and troubleshooting. So that wind turbine maintenance technician, that's one you want to be looking for in your program right now. Now, I don't know if any of the steel mills have had a layoff and these people have been able to be trained. Now, that I don't know. We can sure find out.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned about the closing down the freightways.
Freight lines.
Mm-hmm. And then I'd like to know how many are the involved going to be laid off, and then what's the basic, I know you mentioned competition and global competition, but could you give us why they are closing down and reason, and in the future, how could we compete?
Good question, Representative.
What is the average ages of the people they, you know, that are employed? Approximately, is it 30 or 40s?
I don't know that. I couldn't tell you the answer. I'm going to say that they're probably in their 40s. A lot of these people have been there their whole career. And what happened is Freightliner is actually building a plant in Mexico, Saltillo, Mexico. And they're shutting down the plant in Portland and moving it all down to Mexico. Now, they say that it has nothing to do with competition, but I think we know it all is, and labor costs are much cheaper there. And this is a problem that we need to address. And how we can address those is with fair trade agreements, not free trade agreements. Those trade agreements are killing us. Now, and I'm not just saying that as a union person. I'm just saying that as an American. We can't even fight a war. We can't even put armor jackets on our soldiers overseas, because we've lost our manufacturing base, and we're losing it quickly. And we need to start bringing that to attention. It's not only an economic issue. It's a national security issue.
And this would also speak to the work that you're going to hear about next from the manufacturing strategy. If we do want to keep our jobs here in Oregon, we need to have our people be very, very productive, and we need to make efficient use of time and effort here. And so that's what the next work that you'll be hearing about is, how do we do that here in Oregon? What does that look like?
Please, Representative.
Yes, I asked about how many are they are going to be laid off, and also if you mentioned average age is about 40s, it's kind of already late set, and could we retrain and retool them to be employed someplace else?
Absolutely, Representative Lim. When the mill shut down in Central Oregon, many people came to us to get into our apprenticeship program. The average age in our apprenticeship program for the electricians, for the IBW, is 34.7. So, yeah, we can retrain them. In fact, these people, you really want them because they're drug-free as a rule. They show up on time. They show up fit for duty. They've got good work ethic. We actually want them. We're actually, you know, it's kind of a bad thing to say, but when those places shut down, that's really a boon to us in the skilled trades sector of, like, steam fitting and electrician's work.
Panel member Culligan.
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, I just would like to respond to this. I know that Jerry Fletcher probably has this information because he's in a labor network that understands when layoffs are coming and hears about them. And I just want to say that I don't know that this has been a public announcement that's been made on this yet in terms of the numbers of jobs, when it will happen or how many people, et cetera. And I know that our economic development agency is working closely with them.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative, they haven't announced the amount of number because they're saying some will be transferred, whatever. So the specific amount is still cloudy right now.
Thank you. Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question that just kind of occurred to me. You know, Mr. Fletcher is from a labor background, and I know in Ms. King's initial statement you were saying that it's, you know, these boards are made up of both labor and business. And so I'm curious what the makeup, is there a ratio that is adhered to for the makeup of our regional boards, and can you give me an example of how many labor people in relationship to business people are on these boards?
Well, I can tell you how many labor people are on it. There's only three, and the rest are either public or private sector.
And how many numbers would that be, follow up, please?
Lita, could you help me out on that, what our specific numbers are?
Chair, Representative Holdy, the Workforce Board has about 25 people on it right now. It, by federal statute, it's a business majority. And then there are specific slots by federal statute as well that have to be filled. There are three labor representatives on the current board, 12 or 13 business members, and then people from community-based organizations, local elected officials, legislators. You know, we have a whole list, and it's actually in state statute as well. And on the local boards, it's the same type of composition, but the boards are larger usually than our state board is.
Larger or smaller?
Larger.
Mm-hmm. Large majority.
Yeah, Representative Holby, I will say that this board, even though only three people of labor are on it, labor's voice is heard. We have an executive board of five people. Two of those people are on the are from labor on that executive board. So they're listening, because if you can't keep the workforce happy, you don't have much of a workforce. So it's got to be a buy-in by both sides.
Jerry, in a previous committee meeting, we heard extensive testimony about the importance of education to the development of our workforce. It was also stated that roughly 70% of Oregon's students will not be going on to college for various reasons. In the context of a need for education, would you please tell us the importance of apprenticeship?
Absolutely. It's something that we have really looked into, and we are going to start a strategy of starting to educate our young people. One of my jobs is I go into middle schools, and I actually tell kids about the trades. And like four people out of 100 will make more than a skilled craftsman in the construction trades. We've got to educate our young people that you don't have to go to college to be successful. There's skilled trades out there. There's other apprenticeship programs. Earn while you learn. And what's good about earn while you learn is you have a responsibility not only to learn, but to keep your job so you can keep a paycheck. So you get that accountability where if a person going to college, they can drop out at any time. In apprenticeship, when they drop out, they don't get paid either. They lose a paycheck. So you have a little bit more of a buy-in by that person. So we have to educate our young people that apprenticeships are out there, but it's not for the ones that don't want to work either, because actually apprenticeship is harder than going to college, because you have to work, then you have to go to school at night. So we have a big education process from every one of you. We need to start educating about apprenticeship because it's a great way to go, but it's also a heck of a commitment.
Thank you. Not seeing any further questions. Thank you all very, very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
And we are very much in favor of the good work that is being done at OWIB, so keep it up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate the time. Please do use us a resource. We have worked hard to provide the voice, so please work with us. Thank you.
Hope to be able to hear from you throughout the session, too.
You can count on it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Next, talking about workforce strategies, we're going to be hearing from the Manufacturing Workforce Committee. And if we would please come forward, Charlie Lake and Audrey Thies, please, project manager. And Audrey, if I butchered your last name, my apologies.
Good morning. It's Tice.
Thank you.
But many people make that mistake.
And if you would, welcome. Please identify yourselves for the record before you begin, and thank you very much for appearing here this morning.
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, I'm Charlie Lake. I'm a business owner. I own Warren Manufacturing Company. I'm also one of the founders of the Northwest High Performance Enterprise Consortium, affectionately referred to in the future as HPEC. And also, as a board member from that, I'm responsible for the execution of the Oregon Manufacturing Workforce Strategy.
And I'm Audrey Tice. I am president of Keylinks, Inc., which is a national economic and workforce development company based in Portland. And I'm here today on behalf of the Manufacturing Workforce Strategy, and I serve as project manager for that initiative.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Witt, I would like to maybe build a little bit of history here so that you understand what HPEC is all about and how that interrelates with the manufacturing workforce strategy. We were founded in 2002. It was five Oregon-based companies with a common interest, and that was high-performance manufacturing. And the reason for that was to improve global competitiveness and keep businesses and jobs here. And that's a strong motivating factor in why companies gravitate toward these consortia. The basically, we serve as a community of practice, and the way it works is we're a 501c6 group. We are governed by a board of seven volunteers out of the industry. They're elected by the membership. And we provide opportunities for employees, including management, to be involved in learning experiences. These are in several forms. There's special interest groups, which is focused around a specific topic where people come and share their knowledge, and people can come and learn about that specific kind of knowledge. We have executive forums where we bring in top speakers, authors from around the globe to provide insights into directions and vision. We have learning tours where people are invited to a company from outside the company to come and participate in not only touring the company, but actually taking activities to focus on improvement areas. And that the benefit of that is you get outside eyes, and the people that come through are have a learning experience as well. It kind of gets them out of the box, if you will. We also have high-performance training classes, and those are provided by the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Project, which is OMAP, and that's typically done at a host company, and the training is done at the host company, and then basically the whole group moves out to the production floor and actually performs the training. It's a very powerful, hands-on, high-retention learning experience, and it's a great way to bring up a large number of incumbent workers up the curve. This learning is truly what we would call just in time, and that's where the member companies identify needs and they invite these people in. And the reason I am spending so much time about that is our model, and it is a very powerful learning model. If you take a look at the list that I gave you, you'll see the number of companies that are participating with Northwest HPEC today. It's quite a diverse group. You will see that it's large companies, it's small companies, it's multi-industry. The interesting thing is that the learning experience is beneficial because you go to another type of company. So the cross-industry is very important to be able to open up your eyes to the learning experience. The In 2006, Northwest HPEC had the opportunity to submit an application to lead the implementation of the Oregon Manufacturing Workforce Strategy, and I will summarize for you what the four bullet points are on that strategy. Link regionally based centers of manufacturing activity. Expand the reach of high-performance manufacturing practices and techniques to create more competitive companies. 3, fill the skilled worker shortage by investing in training of current workers and attracting new workers to high-demand occupations. And 4, raise awareness about the value of Oregon's manufacturing industry and high-wage career opportunities. HPEC is uniquely suited to this because we have an industry-led consortium that is diverse and broad. And so we're pleased to have been awarded the opportunity to lead this contract. And
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm having trouble hearing, and I think it would be helpful if the witness moved a little bit further away from the microphone so it would distort less.
We're just trying to get the right distance here, Charlie. Excuse us.
And people tend to swallow the mic, and it doesn't work very well that way.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. And for the rest of the audience, our audiovisual equipment in the room is quite sensitive. So you have to kind of find the right distance here for the equipment to be able to hear you most clearly. So,
Mr. Chair, I apologize for interrupting, but I get to the point where I'm not listening to what's being said, but I'm hearing the distortion.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. I was reluctant to interrupt the witness, but I was aware of the same thing. So
thank
you very much for that. That's probably good right there, Charlie, so try it.
How does that sound?
That's
can you hear me?
Better.
I'll try and freeze.
you can relax.
Even further away might be better.
Yes. Representative Barnhart and Chair Witt, I apologize. I'm a little nervous as well.
You're doing very well.
That's quite all right. I apologize for the interruption. It never helps.
We are in choosing our direction for this, we put together a steering committee, and on the third page of your handout, you'll see the members of that steering committee. One thing that you will notice is that we have selected members. This is a working group of people. These are people that are important management-level people that have large human resource issues they deal with daily. They're located all over the state. You'll see that we have people from Southern Oregon, from Eastern Oregon, from Central Oregon, even some from the Portland area. And basically, if you look, and you will see also that they represent not only a number of industries, but they are also connected with lots of organizations, the Defense Coalition, Manufacturing 21, the food processing folks. And so what we really try to do is get a very comprehensive group of people to be able to address the issues statewide regarding geography, different types of business, et cetera. And so at the same time, we've brought in a project manager, Audrey Tice, who you've met, who has a wealth of experience because she was also responsible for business retention and employee development in the state of Maryland. So we're pretty excited about that. To move forward, we really, in the first phase of this, we have $500,000 that was given to us in the first phase. And so the first part of that is to really initiate the communication part of this. So we have engaged a firm to get the word out and also establish a web-based communication tool, which will help us provide linkages to all the different activities that are happening around the state, both in industry and in government. The other part of this is to take the HPEC model and get it out there. And so what we did is we sent letters out to every agency around the state that we knew of that had connections with outside industry and said, please, if you have a group that's thinking about getting together, submit an application to us. We have received 5 applications around the state. And these applications, we have actually sent out agreements on 4 of them now. The 5th one is in consideration. And you can see on the handout on page 2 that it is a very comprehensive group of companies. And the other thing that that is interesting in this, we started as 5 and we thought, gee, I hope some other people are interested in this, and we now have 87 companies. It is compelling what this does. So if you look at that list of companies and realize that those are the ones that are aware today of what they need, they're going to talk with their friends and their business compatriots and the local agencies, and what's going to happen is they're going to get excited about this and move forward. So part of our business here is to help these groups get started. We're giving them seed funding. We are giving them all of the knowledge and the skills and the tool sets that we have developed over the year to help get them into a sustainable state. This is not a member contribution problem. It's strictly volunteer. But us being able to give them some money really helps them pull forward in that. I'm going to give you a little bit of an idea what this can do because I'm a small business owner. I mean, that's not my roots, but I did it anyhow. And it's always a scary thing, but I bought my business 6 years ago, and I started doing these high-performance techniques, and I can testify what's happened to my business in that period of time, 350% revenue growth. Most of that's due to delivering quality. When you do that, it gives you the opportunity to go out and address markets that you might not have been in before. The other thing you have to do is you always have to be aware that you're providing value, but people are only willing to spend so much. So making your costs is part of it, and that's part of this whole competitive formula and why jobs are moving out, because they can get cost better elsewhere. The nice thing about these techniques is it helps you stave off that. I have increased profit margins 14%. During that period of time, mainly through productivity improvements. And productivity increases of 256%. That's not one-shot deals, okay? That is hundreds and hundreds of small improvement projects. Again, we're talking about get your employees involved. It makes them excited. They look at what they do and they say, this can be done better. And what you want to do is you want to encourage that, and that's a big part of what we bring to the party. Average wage increase is 68%. It's interesting work because the people have a look at what they're doing and they have a say in how it's done, and they make their lives better daily. It provides for high morale. People have a good time. You can walk out and you can hear them singing and laughing and doing things. It's kind of fun. A worldwide export business. About 20% of my business is export, and it has continued to grow at the same pace. And that is because we provide a good product, and we keep our costs at check. And yet, our employees are making a very good living. I'd like to thank you very much for allowing me to talk about this. And what I'd like to do is allow Audrey Tice to talk in a little bit more about the program itself of the Oregon Workforce Strategy.
Thank you very much, Audrey.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Lynn, Vice Chair Riley, and members of the committee. I'm going to spend a few minutes this morning giving you just a brief overview of the Oregon Manufacturing Workforce Strategy. That initiative, and you have several documents in front of you, was one of the first sectoral initiatives of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, as described by Elizabeth King just a few minutes ago, out of recognition of the critical importance of manufacturing to the state's economy. The Oregon Workforce Investment Board convened a comprehensive committee that included representation of business, labor, education, government, and community organizations last year and had a very comprehensive process to look at the challenges facing manufacturing and to develop some specific strategies for addressing them. They were charged with coming up with some concrete recommendations that could be implemented over the next 4 years. I'm going to review each of those areas briefly, both the challenges and the opportunities and the recommended solutions. But before I begin, I just want to sound three themes that you'll hear through my comments that are reflected in the documents you have before you. The first is systems. There is actually a lot of good, very important work going on regarding manufacturing and manufacturing workforce development across the state. It's a big state. There are different regions. There are different industry sector groups involved with initiatives. There are different community colleges working on these themes and issues. But there is no one place now where anyone can go to find out about all of it. And, in fact, there are many common challenges that each group is working on independently. So a part of the theme here or the intent is really sort of connecting the dots, bringing together, serving as a broker of all these pockets of activity so that we as a state, you as a legislature, can get an idea of the gestalt, the big picture. The second theme is strategic. We need to be strategic about limited and targeted investments on both the private and public side. We know resources are limited, so the intent of the plan was to look ahead 4 years from now and ask the question, where does the state want to be? What are the metrics that we need to follow to gauge our progress? What will success look like if we are moving forward to help Oregon businesses become more competitive and Oregon workers get the skills that they need to fuel the economy? The third theme is sustainability. This is not about a new program that's going to go away when the money runs out. This is about scaling a sustainable statewide system to support and ensure Oregon manufacturers that they have the knowledge workers that are needed to drive innovation and high performance in their firm, for all of them to achieve the kind of results that Charlie Lake just described his company has experienced over the past 5 years. And just a few brief facts to underscore the importance of manufacturing in the state. I know you're all aware of them, but the numbers are compelling. There are 200,000 workers currently involved in manufacturing establishments and over 6,000 firms across the state, many of which are small, with 50 employees or fewer. But they generate an annual payroll of over $9.8 billion. And the traded sectors, and we're very comprehensive and use manufacturing as an overarching umbrella, include high-tech semiconductors, metals, transportation equipment, food processing, wood and paper products, and increasingly at the regional level, new and growing emerging areas of manufacturing like aviation and the wind turbine initiative referenced in the earlier testimony. All of these sectors sell their goods outside the state and outside the country, bringing revenue into the state, which is why it is so critical that we make targeted investments to help them compete in this dynamic global economy. And manufacturing jobs do provide good high-wage jobs. Manufacturing does provide good high-wage jobs. The average wage across all workers in manufacturing is over $53,000. That is 46% higher than the average state wage. Now, that does include from line workers up through management. But these are good jobs. And a very important point that I want to underscore about manufacturing is that it is one of the most critical sectors in which even entry-level workers can earn a living wage in most companies, and there are multiple career paths to numerous high-demand, high-wage occupations. And a part of the challenge is preparing Oregonians to take advantage of those and fill those critical need jobs. But having said that, Oregon faces, like all other states, just unparalleled challenges. Things are happening so fast. We are really in a catch-up mode. And many states have aggressively addressed this issue over the past 5 years, developing plans. So Oregon's right there in the mix, but we need to really focus some targeted investments and targeted resources on this issue. The committee that developed the plan, and the original plan, you have a copy, looks like this, is the executive summary. I will leave the full plan with your staff. It's about 60 pages long, and if you each want one, we do have copies of those. But I provided the executive summary. The themes are also in this new brochure. It's literally hot off the press. We wanted to try to connect this activity to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board plan that you've seen. So it has a slightly different look and is intended to be a little bit more consumer friendly. I'm just going to spend my remaining time going through the four critical issues identified by the planning committee that wrote this, and then some of their recommendations that we are about the business now of implementing. So the first major challenge, I mentioned before that there is a lot of existing activity out there. Just to tick off a few, and there really is a laundry list, but some that you're probably already familiar with, the Northwest Food Processing Association, major cluster of companies across Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, with literally clusters of food manufacturing processors all over the state. Manufacturing 21, now primarily Portland-based, primarily metals-focused consortium, very engaged in workforce activities. The RV consortium, the recreational vehicle consortium in Eugene and Lane County, three major RV manufacturers and working with their suppliers. They have a location quotient of 2.85. That means that we have the second highest concentration of RV manufacturers of any place in the country. They are more than 2.85 times as likely to locate in Oregon because of the specialization that's now concentrated there. It's a tremendous draw, but they're having trouble getting skilled workers. The Semiconductor Workforce Consortium has been in place for decades. The Pacific Northwest Wind Energy Consortium, a new effort around the wind turbine initiative. A Wood Products Consortium, again, a new effort supported by the OIB with some seed funding. I'm providing some support to them next week at their very first meeting to look at the state plan and how they can focus on wood products and a 10-year plan they are developing. So we've got all these different initiatives. Many of them are dealing with the same issue. So what is the solution? Essentially, the plan calls for creating a network of networks, reaching out, identifying all these different activities, connecting them both through people-to-people contact, but also through some technology and web-based activity, making sure that we know what each is doing and that they have a way of identifying each other and knowing what strategic initiatives each of them is working with. We can't afford to reinvent the wheel. We want to be efficient. We want to maximize limited resources. So our role is to sort of work as the hub of all of these different spokes that are out there and help coordinate them and connect them. The second major strategy is high-performance solutions. Charlie gave a pretty dynamic idea of what that's involved. But we have recent research that was conducted for the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership that says only 16% of Oregon manufacturers report that they are at maximum efficiency in terms of high performance. And here's a really scary figure. Only 1,500 report they have a long way to go, and 30% of the respondents of this survey were unfamiliar with what high performance or lean manufacturing even entailed. And most of these are small manufacturers. We cannot deal with this on a one-on-one basis. So the strategy, the solution is, as Charlie hinted, is to create consortia to bring groups of companies together to work on common issues. And that is the seed funding that he referenced. The $125,000 of the grant went out to local consortia. And here's another scary, it's actually very exciting and scary at the same time. All that money was committed within the first month of our implementation. We had so many requests. And we are now logging in new requests. And those consortia will be seed funded in the Salem area, a cross-cutting group in the Bend area, in the Medford area, the Southern Oregon High Performance Consortium. Johnny, what am I forgetting?
The High Desert. You got
the High Desert, right, in Bend. And we have, again, several other groups. We want to be aggressive and promote this in rural areas where it's critically important and there's just not the concentration. So these are the early adopters. These are the folks who already know that it's an issue and we're helping to organize. A part of the challenge is getting the word out. But the best way to do that is to have companies like Charlie's to have champions in every region where they can speak about the specific outcomes for them. The third area is workforce, and of course, that's the big kahuna. This is so broad and such a challenge. Another survey done by the Employment Department suggested 43% of Oregon manufacturers report a shortage of skilled workers now. They have jobs they could fill now if there were people with the skills they needed. Another pretty compelling statistics, based on the fact that the workforce is aging, from retirements alone and new jobs created over the next decade, we will need 53,000 skilled workers in Oregon to replace retiring workers and fill new jobs. That requires a strategic, targeted initiative. And it's got to take on, it's got to sort of do three things simultaneously. One is it's got to prepare the current workforce, people who are already in manufacturing, keep their skills current so they can take advantage of moving up the pipeline as opportunities are created. The second part of this is there are people who are in the workplace who are either underemployed or who are marginally employed, who are looking for new opportunities but don't see manufacturing as a place where they could use their skills. With some targeted short-term intervention, there are some very exciting models where we can get those into good those people into good manufacturing jobs. And then the third, which is a longer-term strategy, is the whole issue of recruiting and training young talent. Individuals and students in the public high schools and the community college system that have a passion for design or sales or building things, but they are stymied by the outdated image of manufacturing. And the parents think it's dirty and dangerous. Their guidance counselors don't have a clue because they haven't set place in a modern manufacturing environment and don't understand that machinists wear white shirts and make $65,000. We need to change that. And there's a lot of good activity around the country focused on these issues that we can learn from and take advantage of. So on the workforce end, we've got a number of specific issues that we need to address that range all the way from raising the value of the high school diploma to looking at work readiness credentials, emphasizing science and math in the K-16 system, expanding career technical training and apprenticeship. I'm so glad you had that conversation. It's critical that we do that, investing in the capacity of community colleges and universities and the apprenticeship to train for high-demand occupations, and increasing public support for incumbent worker training, those people already in the job who can move up. Having said that, how do you get your hands around such a big agenda? One way is to work through the various consortia that I just identified. You've got companies involved in those. They are self-adopters. They already recognize the importance of investment. They already get it. So all the new consortia, all the existing consortia, we need to work strategically with all the workforce providers in the regions and help target resources working with them. They are essentially learning labs. Those are the laboratories where we can make some of these specific practical changes in and then ultimately, hopefully, bring in the rest of the system over time. And finally, the fourth big issue is communications. The challenge, and I alluded to it just a few minutes ago, the image of manufacturing is still tremendously outmoded and outdated, and we need to promote the importance of manufacturing to key decision makers who themselves perhaps don't understand all the changes. We need to help companies identify why they should participate in high performance. And probably the most important, we need to aggressively promote the career opportunities that are available today. Stealing the best ideas from other states, I'm a great fan of that, and implementing them as fast as we can. And what we propose for this, as Charlie alluded, we have a communications company that we're working with. We do have a hold right now on website, www.oregonmanufacturing.org, and we have some real cool things, some ideas out there, wikis. Anybody else know? I didn't know what a wiki was until last week. I guess I'm behind the term. But it's a new technology that allows, for example, all the companies that are in this consortia to be real-time connected. And somebody has a question about, well, how did you do this? Or we have this problem. They get online and they shoot it out, and we have 250 other companies now in this high consortium groups that can help them solve each other's problems. So that's the overview of the plan. It's kind of the 10,000 foot level. We are working aggressively with all the major stakeholders to put some specific implementation strategies in place. Our steering committee met for the first time last week. We're sort of new into this. The grant came in September, I guess, so we're still kind of in our first quarter of operation. I would conclude my comments with just three suggestions about how the committee can help. Sort of goes to an earlier question to the previous committee. Promote cluster-based framework as a tool. Cluster-based strategies as a tool and a framework for linking economic and workforce development activities. I've seen it work firsthand. It's compelling. It's dynamic. When you help organize at the regional level these organic groups of businesses that are already there, for a variety of reasons, and there's concentrated commonalities, when you organize around those and help structure the supply-side system to meet those needs, it's very efficient, it's very effective. What you see is over, across all of them, a common set of issues that cut across at the bottom, but you get more specialized as you go up in terms of their specific needs. The second thing I would suggest is, hopefully our strategy you might consider as a framework as you look at some of the challenges, not only in manufacturing but other segments of the economy. And the investments that come across your desk in terms of the Skill Up Fund and the Cluster Fund are sorely needed resources that can be targeted to help address some of these manufacturing challenges. And finally, encourage the sharing of national and state best practice. There are highly effective models that already exist out there for many of the challenges that Oregon faces. It's just a little behind the curve on some of it because many of the industrialized states have been very aggressive in this area. We should just find out. And I'm connected in many of those arenas. Gather that information and share it, which is a part of my role as a project manager. So I thank you for your patience with my testimony. I applaud your vision of linking economic and workforce development, and be pleased to support your efforts in any way I can. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very, very much for absolutely wonderful and compelling testimony. Committee members, we're a little bit behind time here for our next panels. Would allow a couple of questions if anyone has any. Don't feel compelled that you have to. I just want to say that, Charlie, your list of manufacturers that are involved in your program is truly, truly, truly impressive, as are the results-oriented statistics that you provided this committee. I think this speaks to the importance, first of all, of high performance, but secondly, that it works, and presumably your company is able to remain competitive as a result. And Audrey, you've charted the pathway for us to make this a reality. Thank you both so very, very much for your absolutely fine testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to hear business perspectives on the importance of workforce development. And I'd like to invite up as a panel from the Oregon Business Council, Duncan Wise, from the Oregon Business Association, Lynn Lundquist, and from the Governor's Small Business Council, Christine Chin Ryan. If you'd all come forward, please. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning.
I'd ask for your indulgence to help us if you can to perhaps get back on time. So if your testimony could be summarized maybe in 5 or 6 minutes, I guarantee you that if you don't get everything out that you want to say, we're very adept at asking lots of questions in this committee. So with that, if you would, please determine your own order. And before you begin your statement, if you would, each of you introduce yourselves for the record. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Duncan Wise, President of the Oregon Business Council.
Christine Chin Ryan, Chair of the Governor's Small Business Council.
Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association.
Why don't I start? Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name again is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council. I also wear another hat. I am on the State Board of Education, and I'd like to briefly talk about the high school diploma requirements, which we adopted last week. And when Ellen gave me the assignment, she suggested I be very brief and that you'd have lots of questions. So I don't have prepared testimony, but I just have a few notes I would make on this topic. And the first point I would make is workforce preparation and education is the big deal in terms of economic competitiveness in this half of the 21st century. And the perspective I have is having interviewed lots and lots of businesses over the years, and I'm going to go back to 1987 when I started doing economic strategy in the middle of a recession into a document that led to what became known as Oregon Shines. And at that time, talking with manufacturing firms and asking them, what's the number one problem you face in Oregon today? It was lack of skilled workers. And in the last recession, when I went through the same exercise and asked for priorities, it was the same issue. We have had this challenge for a long, long time, and we have responded to it in a lot of different ways, and I think made some significant progress over the last 10, 20 years or so. Yet it remains the key opportunity facing our state. And I think we've got to think deeply about what it's going to take to create the environment where Oregon has a competitive advantage in workforce and education so that we have a competitive advantage globally. We're not there yet. We are on national standards. We've got some good work that we can talk about. But I think as a vision for ourselves, we need to say this is what we want to stand for as an area we want to be very, very good at. Second observation I would make is I think through the great, great work of OWIB and the governor's office, we've made more progress on this in the last 2-3 years than I've seen in a long, long time. We've got a strategic board. We've got in the workforce team in the governor's office and in the community college office, they really are focusing on the clusters that you've been hearing about. We've got a good vision about learning and listening to the various sectors, including manufacturing, healthcare, and the various clusters. We've got efforts to organize clusters and learn from them about what their needs are. And I think there are a lot of ways we're connecting those businesses to the operations and the opportunities in education and workforce preparation, and a lot of good proposals. A lot of work has been done, and you're going to see a lot of proposals in this session that I think are going to advance the work. As you approach this, I encourage you to think very broadly about workforce in the context of the entire education investment. As I've thought about this for a long, long time, where I see the opportunity is to look at the workforce system as it's currently defined, which is actually fairly narrow. You talk about the federal funds. Those funds and that system needs to be placed in the context of something much, much larger, which is the entire pre-K-20 system, and how all of those pieces fit into one delivery model that is going to deliver the education and training systems that we need. And in that, I'm going to close with my observations about what we need to do in that regard, and this will not be a surprise to Representative Dahlem, who's been spending a lot of time with some of us lately. We need to transform the education and delivery system in Oregon with very significant goals in mind. The current system is not designed to do what we need for the 21st century. And what we need in the 21st century is an adult population that has roughly the following metrics. Really everybody needs to have a high-quality high school diploma to be successful in the 21st century, not just at work, but for citizenship and to live a rich, rewarding life. By that I mean you need to be able to read, you need to be able to write, communicate, have math skills, and have the teamwork and problem-solving skills to navigate a very complicated society. Everybody needs that. In addition, I would argue another 40% needs to have what you might call an apprenticeship, associate, a technical degree, something beyond high school that will allow you to succeed in those high-performance manufacturing settings, to succeed in apprenticeship programs, succeed in a lot of technical jobs. And those folks need to be retrained continuously throughout their lives because those jobs will change. And another 40%, there's 40% there, and in addition, another 40% need to have a college degree or above. And with the skills associated with the classic liberal arts, plus a lot of those need additional technical and professional training, whether it's in engineering, medicine, nursing, a variety of other fields. That is an enormous ramping up of the education delivery system in our state, and which would take us, frankly, to an unprecedented level. But if we do that, the earnings of Oregonians will rise so significantly, and we'll be so much better off that the society will just simply be a lot stronger. We'll be a much stronger middle class. We'll have higher incomes. You'll have much more money coming into the public sector for additional investment. If we can get on that cycle, it's going to solve a lot of problems that you face in poverty and in the correction system and of great value. So we need to move that way. And I would argue to move that way, you can't get there without redesigning the systems. It's a combination of system redesign and resource allocation to get there. And the system redesign needs to include redesigning the curriculum to help every learner move to their fullest potential. That means a curriculum pre-K through 20 that makes sense to the learner, that allows a learner to come into the system, understand where they are now and how the system can add value to get where they want to go with a clear plan and profile throughout the system. It means you have to have a data system that helps understand the performance of the system at every stage, all the way through to make sure it's always adding value. And last and certainly not least, we need a new budget system that helps you understand where the dollars are going now across the system and what the performance of those dollars are at every stage, and that you're thinking strategically about the public investment in relation to the private investment, making sure you're getting the greatest value out of your dollars. This is a broader, more expansive picture of what you need to be doing, and again, I agree with everything we've been hearing this morning. The Workforce Board has been doing a great job in connecting with the State Board, and we're trying to think about how all this fits together, and I'm just thrilled with the work they're doing. My encouragement is this needs to be, that work needs to be even in a broader context of how we're going to redesign the whole system, and I think that's the challenge we all face together as a state. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Duncan. Representative Dahlem.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Duncan, I'd like to ask, having worked with you on the committee for, it seems like a long, long time, it seems so obvious that we have to restructure our education system and make it target where we want action to take place and make it transparent so everybody can see where the money goes, which is the source of all of my questions. Where's the money going? What's it doing? But I think one of the areas I want you to explain just for a moment is what happens if we don't do this?
Well, again, what will happen, it won't be instant, it will be slow, but gradually the quality of standard of living in Oregon will be lower than it would otherwise be. I mean, I think the context for all this, and you've heard it from the previous witnesses, and I think Charlie Lake did a great job of describing the challenge. In a global economy, we're facing fierce competition, and we cannot compete on a low skill basis. Unless we want to drive our wages to that level, we've got to compete on a high wage, high skill basis with very, very productive firms. And if we don't improve the education delivery system and the workforce preparation system, we're not going to be competitive, and Oregon will be a poor state as a result. And that, of course, will add to the costs you will face in corrections and in criminal justice, as well as the welfare systems. And so the consequences will be seen over time as those results occur. So I think the stakes could not be higher here in terms of what we're doing.
Thank you very much. If we could perhaps hold our questions and comments until the panel's done here. Who's next?
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. The Governor's Small Business Council has been traveling around the state since 2004, listening to concerns of small businesses. Qualified workforce is one of our top seven issues for small businesses. And I will just highlight the items that, since we're limited to 5 minutes. What we heard about skilled workforce. Availability of trained workforce is a primary issue for small and medium-sized businesses. Drug-free workplace has become a central workforce issue. Hurdles of adoption of a drug-free policy threaten the existence of many businesses. The impact or potential impact is loss of workforce. The reality for many small and medium-sized employers is that they risk losing up to 50% of their workforce with the implementation of the drug-free programs. Drug-free workplace is one of the Council's 2007 legislative agenda items, and we heard this many times going across the state. Many employers already incur the cost for impact of drugs in the workplace, absenteeism, safety, health care, legal costs. Cutbacks at the federal and state level in education and workforce funding have increasingly placed a burden on private businesses for mining skilled workforce to staff its business operations. Businesses face the dilemma of carrying increasing cost burden relating to employees while competing in a global market where cost margins are being squeezed and competitive labor costs, for example, China, India, are far below U.S. wages. Many employees or job applicants in U.S. today don't even come with basic math and language skills. Many employers have developed their own programs with local high schools and community colleges, and others have started internal training programs to help attract and promote good work ethics. It was suggested that a fairly mobile younger working class outreach to community college trade programs around the state might have value. Many large businesses in Oregon create and maintain combination skilled trade training employment programs with several of the community colleges across the state and thus tap a continuous resource pool of skilled workforce via a variety of trade education programs that participate in funding in one way or the other. This idea could be evaluated to a more widespread application and could benefit from participation of medium and small businesses as well. Demographically, Oregon and Portland metro area has seen a higher than average increase in in-migration of young, highly educated residents. Many move here without employment and are coming for the quality of life. The upside is that we need these types of people. Downside is the impact to Oregon residents also in search of employment. Many industry sectors are being challenged with the increasing number of retirees and fewer younger individuals to fill those skilled and seasoned positions. Downside, many training programs can't keep high enough levels of graduates due to drugs, work ethics. I know at the federal level and utility companies, you know, linemen are in need. There's a big gap between the ones you're going to retire in 5 years and the ones at the junior entry-level positions. The upside here is that some segments are being addressed, increased nursing programs, and there is the opportunity to retain semi-retired employees as part of time workers to maintain experience levels. There are many existing programs. We need to fund and publicize them. The need for vocational education and training is urgent since a large number of high school graduates do not go on to higher education. Many blue-collar jobs pay living wages, family or primary wage jobs. We also need to inform our young workforce that blue-collar jobs are valuable and well-paying nowadays. We need to build educational and employment incentive, skilled labor education and training programs, which would attract the young workers and encourage them to take their training and job ethics seriously, because good work performance in the skilled labor trades will give them a good perspective for a productive and financially secure future. Just as a note, I'm from the white-collar knowledge-based technology company. I do customized software development in the energy industry. My husband is from the blue collar, so I can hear both sides of it. Also, I just want to note that the Governor's Small Business Council will be giving a presentation to legislatures February 2nd. We had to reschedule because of the weather 12 to 2. We would love to have you come and hear more about our position statements and our legislative agenda items. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Christine. Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. Duncan and I have probably been around quite a while together, and I just want to say a strong second amen to his comments. We didn't talk ahead of time what each one was going to talk about, but I pretty well knew what Duncan was going to talk about. And so I just want to, first of all, just say that we really, really believe in that. Our association has been heavy on this whole like education arena for a long, long time. I'll just try to have a few other comments, and I'll keep this fairly brief. And I'll actually split it into a little bit, I think, talking about the workforce and then about economic development. You know, I think you're in a golden opportunity because I sense that, as Duncan indicated here the last couple of years or so, there really, for the first time, in my opinion, has been that significant push on workforce development and economic development. I don't think we've talked about it for a long time, and he's done a lot, and others have done a lot of work, but it seems like we sort of have, now it's risen to the top. And so you sit, I think, in an ideal position in order to help move that along. In our structure of the association, we have committees that obviously put the agenda together. And for the first time, we had three committees that focused in on this one issue in addition to other things. In other words, before that was primarily in the Environment and Economic Development Department or committee that we did that. I just point that out. I think the move is there. And I think you need to seize that opportunity and move forward with it. You know, everyone knows that the quality of the workforce is important, but it's more than just important. It's absolutely essential. It's not a matter of filling the jobs. It's a matter of who you fill the jobs with and how productive they are when it gets there. And that's, you know, sort of a glib statement, you might say. It's not. That is absolutely critical. And so it's the responsibility, I think, of yours in the state to jumpstart so that the people that come into the workforce are ready. Obviously, we have an obligation as employers. We don't expect you to do it all, but we have an obligation to further that. But it's critical for the productivity of our companies. You know, if you really take a look at it, if we as a state do not do everything we can to keep the workforce trained, we really are foregoing a great human resource. We really are. I call it unleashing the talent. I think that's what we need to do. We need to unleash the talent of our citizens for the betterment of the whole state. Just briefly on economic development, I happen to reside in Crook County over here a lot of the time. I happen to be Crook County Commissioner now, and we know how critical in rural Oregon economic development is to our future. It is extremely critical. I want to talk about one thing, the enterprise zones. You know, that's that needs to be extended again. At sunset, I think in 09, I believe it is, and I think there's a bill to extend it out into the 20s. That's absolutely essential. I just want to give you this one little example. It's right next, fairly close to me, in a little place called Powell Butte in Crook County. There's a gentleman that's been manufacturing flatbeds for pickups and bumpers and that sort of thing on his farm. Okay, now he's moving into the industrial area of Crook County. Why? Because of an enterprise zone that gives him the tax advantage to do that. Now, I just throw that out, just a little tiny example. It is absolutely imperative that that is extended. Because, as sure certainly the chair and all of you know, that jobs are the key to the success of this state. It's the jobs and the profit of businesses that pay the bills. Just the bottom line. That's what it is. I simply think that it's an opportunity, and I'll just close by saying this. Having been around the political process a little bit, I know that all of these kind of issues need a champion or two. So I don't know who wants to step up and be that, but it takes a champion to make these things happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very, very much. Yes, Vice Chair Lynn.
Thank you very much. And in your program of workforce development, you have emphasized the skilled workers, math and English, maybe science, plus many others. But are you including any curriculum such as ethics and then values? Because without it, how skilled the person might be is not going to work. such as the drug programs. Are you incorporating any of those issues in the workforce program?
Well, who can answer that question? I don't know. I'm just throwing
that is on the state board.
This is a very tough one, Representative Lim. In terms of the curriculum requirements in high school, where, I mean, obviously those social responsibility, citizenship skills, teamwork, and working in groups are all part of the redesigned diploma. Ethical education is I need to get back, think more about what we specifically require on ethics in terms of our standards, and I would like to review that, and I would come back to you on that. But I would completely agree with you that as we look to the future, education is simply not just the common, you know, the set of specific skills. It's also, you know, the whole person. And obviously individual school districts have the responsibility of focusing on that as well as we need to think about it at the state level in terms of the standards we set. So I agree with you.
Okay, I have just one more follow-up, please. Thank you. It could be a follow-up. It could be a different matter, but are we alone here in nationally that we need more skilled workers, or this is a national phenomenon that we need more skilled workers? And how could we feel it, or we are continually influx from the other countries seeking better opportunity, but it seems to me we are not able to produce our own. And can you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Lim, it is a national issue, no question about it. I mean, my peers in other states, we all have the same priorities. We are competing globally on this issue, but I think we can distinguish ourselves within the national context if we work hard at this, but it is a national problem. In-migration is one strategy for meeting workforce needs, both internationally and nationally. And Oregon has been very successful at that, frankly, more successful than other states in terms of attracting very talented people, as Christine mentioned. At the same time, if we don't focus on our own pipeline of services to Oregonians, I think we're never going to meet all the demand, and we're certainly not going to serve our Oregonians well. So, I mean, I think, well, it's great that we are attracting talented people. We don't want to discourage that. I think we're very, very need to be very, very focused on making sure that Oregonians have these opportunities as well.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
I just wanted to mention Representative Lim about ethics. As a business owner, I've had many discussions with other business associates on the same issue, and I've gone through, like many business owners, where we hire employees. My average wage is $65,000 plus full benefits. That's incredible, better than medium or large businesses. And the ethics is not there, and we've talked about how do we instill ethics in the workplace, and it's a very difficult issue for us, even though we've tried many things. And most of us, I think, our ethics come from how we were brought up, so I would think that, you know, maybe going back there and finding a way working with other groups in starting that within the, you know, the family. But also on the workforce issue, I also have actually a couple of H-1B visas as well as American citizens. And it is very hard to find qualified workforce in my skill level. That's a very high paid job. It's very, you know, I'm the family wage job company you'd love to have in Oregon because it does bring in a lot more income tax. I think the universities years ago were really challenged when they were getting a lot of bad press about not meeting the needs of employees. I think they've done a lot to come further ahead. I've worked with some of the universities and know some of them that have worked to meet those challenges, but still we still need to continue that process. And as far as within my industry, the vocational training part of it, as far as when I say vocational training in the knowledge-based industry, there are some programs that are not four-year programs that I think is adequate to meet the needs for entry-level positions in my industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you very much. Representative Gerard. think Representative
Barnhart. Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative thank you, Mr. Chair.
Barnhart, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. That's fine. First, a quick comment. I think the ethics piece is of course a critical one, and it does begin at home. It also continues in group interaction training in early elementary school, and wise school districts as a part of their process of getting students able to sit and learn in groups in class are also teaching basic interaction skills and teamwork skills and problem-solving skills starting at the early elementary level. When you do that, you don't have fights in high school. You do have students who pay attention to work, to school, and people who come out of school are ready to act ethically, even if they haven't had an ethics course. So those are critical. The question I had really, and I think it's directed to Duncan, but the others might want to look at it too, is when I hear the words that you said about essentially retooling our education system, what I hear is very, very substantial change. That the traditional, as I interpret it at least, the traditional middle school and high school curriculum needs to be either speeded up or significantly modified in order to bring the community into the school and the school into the community, and especially into the workforce. Would you comment on that thought, anybody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, the system needs to be vastly redesigned, and it has a number of elements, probably more than we want to, I'd love to talk further on this, probably more than we have time for this morning, but I think at the core of it, in terms of the middle school, high school experiences, we have to create the assumption that all students can meet high standards and have the teamwork skills and the problem-solving skills. And when we passed the diploma requirements last week, that was the underlying theory, and there was a lot of support for that. There's obviously a lot of concern about students, but a very diverse group from higher ed to the AFL-CIO, Tom Chamberlain, supporting higher standards for all students. To meet that, you have to redesign the systems because you have to create a wider variety of learning opportunities to motivate and encourage each student to find their path. And so you have to have more specialization, if you will, in terms of customization to help students, whether they're going on to college or on to those apprenticeship programs. The final piece, and just on a quick overview of this, is that's the minimum. We also need to create opportunities for accelerated learning for those who want more to go further. This is not trying to create a rigid set of standards that everyone's simply going to meet. We want to encourage those who want to go well beyond, and those who need more time to get the time they need to meet those high standards. So, a lot of change, and as part of that change, the curriculum has to align much more closely with the community college, the apprenticeship programs, and the higher ed programs. So a lot of change required to make this work.
Representative Barnhart, I was thinking really the same thing myself, and I think we have the whole committee lined up here with a question now. So I'm gonna just jump in because I think this is related very much to your question. Duncan, without putting you on the spot, and I know you said that it would take a lot more time than we're prepared to deal with, but could you give an example of how that education system might look a little different than it does now?
Well, I think the best way to visualize this is actually see what's happening on the ground, and I can go all around the state to the Cal Center out in Representative Lim's area. I think North Clackamas School District, do we have any North, is a good example where you have high schools that have high standards for all students, and some people don't like the word, but they basically require the SIM for graduation. Those standards, whether you like the SIM, they have high standards. They have applied learning experiences for all students, whether they're going on to four-year colleges or off to apprenticeship, because what we've learned is students taking that academic work and applying it in some context helps solidify the learning, and it improves
the graduation rates. And so the other feature I would say to achieve that is to create a lot more flexibility in learning opportunities. We have more magnet schools today. We have more students learning in community colleges and higher ed settings and in independent learning opportunities. We're going to see a lot more diversity of choice for students in the high school years so that they can get what they need in a variety of contexts. And again, we see it within a variety of settings in the school systems today. So those are some examples. And again, the other example I would stress is when you're ready for college or community college level work, we need to start providing it. We're seeing a great acceleration of AP classes and higher ed classes and advanced classes in the teenage years today, and we need to keep accelerating that because that helps motivate students. But again, I stress the biggest sea change in all this is the expectations that everyone can succeed. And we have to, the system was not designed. Historically, the system had high dropout rates. It has high dropout rates today. We've got to design a system that assumes every student, you know, starting at 11, 12, 13, is going to be able to go on and meet high expectations. We've got to design the system to do that.
Thank you very much. Now, Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I'm like everyone else here. The figure of the model that you have is really, I think, information that I really would like to have, and I'm sure everybody here would like to have. You state that we need to have more choice in especially K through 12. Are we starting to look at this is a word that was chastised a long time ago, but something like a voucher system? I asked a tough question. Yeah. Sorry.
Representative Witt, Representative Gerard, I don't think there are a variety of ways to get where we need to go, and I'm not advocating for any specific policy like that. I think what we are seeing within the public system right now is are many more programs, different designs for programs within the public setting. And again, without getting into that policy issue, what I am saying is that's what we're seeing. If you look at teenagers, they are looking for a variety of places to learn, and we're seeing that kind of delivery emerging, and we probably do need to accelerate it. How you get there, I'm not going to get into that conversation here.
Let me
have one quick follow-up. Several of us, in fact, a lot of the committee represent rural areas, and the problem that I have is we have small school districts. So where in Portland you might have an apprentice program for everything under the sun, from electricians to plumbers to whatever, but that might not be available in a small school district, and that's why you can call it choice, you can call it voucher. I don't care. But it just seems like we're going to have something so that there would be some fluidity to the educational system so that people in smaller school districts can get the same advantage that would be offered perhaps in Multnomah County school districts.
Ms. Chair, Representative Gerard, I agree with that goal. That we need to find ways to allow students to find what they need, and it can be distance learning, obviously, is one way to do that. It can be partnerships with the local community college. I don't know how eager your students are going to be to come to Portland for education. It could be customized education as part of the curriculum. I mean, that is maybe weeks where you go in terms of customized curriculum. I think we need to get extremely creative about finding different ways of delivering services to meet students' needs. And in the case of rural Oregon, I know a lot of those young people want to stay where they are, and they don't want to necessarily move to get their education. We need to figure out how to design education services to meet their needs.
Christine?
I think we have an example in Baker City, Eastern Oregon. Bayer Manufacturing actually worked with the high schools and community colleges there for internship programs, and they still couldn't find enough students for their manufacturing, welders, and so on. So I think partnering with the larger businesses there that have a need, working with the high schools and community colleges, is probably one solution that I think will help. It'll keep that also the population within that community.
Representative Dahl.
Yes, this question is to Duncan. I think last time I gave you a high fluff ball. Change the pace here a little bit. We have been working together for a long time, 18 months, perhaps 2 years. And rural Oregon is no different than metropolitan Oregon. Rural mom is no different than urban mom. They desperately want their kids to succeed. And what we're finding is they'll do what they have to do. But my question, Duncan, we've heard this morning, and if we just sew all of this stuff together, the jobs are there. We have people that may be underemployed or not getting enough job training in school. We can see a bright future, but what's the rub? Why can't we roll our system over in a more timely manner? Why can't we start or when I hear the number of jobs and the percentage of skilled people that we're going to need, what's holding us up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, there's no simple single answer to that, and I hope your committee spends all session thinking about that issue and we all think about this together. I think partly it are the silos we've created. The system is pretty rigid, and again, the curriculum isn't lined up. We need to recognize the world we're looking into has to be extremely flexible, and that the problems we have today will not be the problems tomorrow, and we have to have a system that allows the education and training services to adapt to the changing needs without, frankly, coming to the legislature. And I'll give you a quick example. When we did focus groups in 97, we did with all our members, including the healthcare folks, the message at the time was, we cannot see a workforce shortage in any time in the foreseeable future. Today, it's the number one issue. Things change. It's very hard to anticipate those changes. And the only way, and there are thousands and thousands of job categories out there that are constantly shifting and changing. So part of the design work we have to have is how do we create the flexibility of the system that allows the system to naturally adapt. And I don't know the answer to that, but it's not a centralized model where we try to figure it all out in Salem. It won't work. So there's got to be a design model that allows that flexibility to happen in the field. And again, that's where I think the cluster work and the local work becomes very, very important. But I think, again, there's no simple answer. I don't have a full answer. That's the question you're asking is the question we need to keep asking until we have satisfied ourselves that we've answered it. And it won't, and again, it's going to be a multi-month, multi-year task.
Well, then this committee should, as I look at this first plan and I started putting every one of the solutions to our problem is education. Every one of them. So this committee should, in this session, sit hard on what are we doing to move this agenda, and are we in the game, out of the game, or standing in the way of the game? And we should be asking that continually.
Christine.
I would like to add there is a lot of programs out there, and I'm really focusing more on the vocational training that we've heard across the state as far as the skilled workforce, welders, plumbers, and so on. There's a lot of programs out there that exist. In fact, I had my husband help me do research on this since I only had a couple of minutes, and he says it really, you know, there's a lot of programs out there, and it's underfunded and it's not publicized. A lot of people don't know about them, a lot of employers, and I think the funding really needs to take a look at that. So at least on the vocational aspects of things, on the short term, I think you can do something about it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim talked about the ethics just a little bit. I want to just make a comment here that's a little bit maybe not in the core part of what we're talking about today, and yet I think it does have some bearing. You talk about things that we need to look at. I think we need to have a cultural shift in our society in regard to how they look on the jobs that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I think demand drives things. Demand drives things. And we, you know, we're all probably guilty. I'm guilty of that. We don't very often tell our kids, you know, you need to really get the best high school education you can so you'll be a plumber. Well, that's wrong. We should be telling them that. So somehow we need to get that little cultural shift going on so we have the demand to drive this, because demand will help us more than anything else to give us the education that Representative Dahl talks about.
Thank you very, very much. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. Most of what I think you were hearing this morning is that we need to improve the feedback system so that the connection between education and workforce works both ways. Right now, what happens is that we have students coming out of school with a set of skills that may not be congruent with what they need in order to work in the workforce. Part of what you have been telling us this morning, and part of what other people have been telling us this morning, is that you've been getting out into the community to find out what it is that employers need and what it is the economy demands. And somehow or another, getting that information back into our education system and into retraining programs and all that is the key. In a capitalist society, we assume we have adequate feedback because of the price system and things of that sort. But in this area, at least, it's obvious we don't. And if we're going to get to that flexibility that Duncan talks about and the other things that we've been talking about, the legislature's task, it sounds like to me, and I'd like a comment if you have one, it sounds like our task is to figure out how to design that feedback loop, get it into place, and then get out of the way.
Partly, that is. I think that is a very big part of it. How do you design the system? The other thing we haven't talked much about, and it's a much larger conversation, is the budget model. Understanding how much you're spending for different services, because a lot of the programs we're talking about do cost more, and the apprenticeship, the technical education programs, and whether you fund it or it's higher fees, whatever. However, we've got to have a strategy for incenting the colleges and high schools to provide those, in some cases, higher cost programs. The example I would give you, where you've intervened is in engineering, where you put additional dollars in engineering. We're seeing a big expansion in engineering in Oregon, and it's great, and I hope it's helping companies like yours. We need a budget model that helps think about your role in creating those incentives.
And Representative Barnhart, I think, underscores that government has a role.
Absolutely.
But at this point, we also have a very big challenge.
Yes.
Yes. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. We've been talking a lot about middle school, high school, and college, but we all know that things start a little earlier than that. The learning experience starts much earlier than that. And I'm concerned about the fact that even at the very early stages, students learn different things in different speeds and in different ways. And I think that we need, and I'd like your comments on this, I believe we need to look much younger than middle school to start this redesign, if you will.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, absolutely. Pre-K through 20 is the vision we have. And the focus, actually, the great news in Oregon education is the elementary school successes around reading and math. We've seen some substantial improvement, and that isn't accidental. I mean, in fact, you go out to those elementary schools, they are much more focused, especially on reading these days, than they ever have been, and it's paying off. So that's great news. But it's earlier than that. It's preschool. I mean, we know there's vast differences. Kids enter school, and we need to focus on those issues as well. I'd also stress the other end. There are a lot of great continuing lifelong learning programs. For example, the community college is focusing on customized, what they call chunked education, to help those who don't necessarily have the skills as adults get those skills in context of work. There's a lot. To succeed in this environment, we need to think about the system really birth all the way through adulthood.
Representative Polby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the comments from the three of you. I agree with many of the points you've made. But I am I'm listening to all this, and though I agree with you, I'm thinking, where do we get the money? And, that's a big issue. Our educational system used to have shop classes in it. It used to have that vocational training. But with the huge disinvestment in education that we've witnessed over the past several years, those programs do not exist anymore. And now we're complaining that we don't have that sort of educational system in our public schools anymore. And, to bring that around, how do we fund that? We're funding that through our revenue system, through income taxes predominantly, and, our wage earners put in the bulk of money into our state, and we've seen corporate and input into this state decline dramatically as productivity grows, and our wage levels have remained fairly stagnant. And so you're asking these wage earners who haven't seen any great rise in their wages to put in more money to beef this system back up, which it needs to happen. And, you know, just bringing that around, I know the business plan, Michael Porter and many others have identified that Oregon and even our Economic Development Department identified that we need to strive for higher wage jobs. And, you know, so that we can, you know, get the revenue out of the workers to pay for all these systems that we need for our businesses to be profitable. So I guess, you know, my idea is, you know, when we go to invest in industries through economic development or through training or anything, should we really be focusing on what kind of wage levels they're going to produce for the state? You know, I can think of one that was talked about earlier, the RV manufacturing. You know, it's a huge industry and a great boon to Oregon, you know, is being relatively new, maybe not extremely new, but it's been growing. But I would challenge, you know, the medium wage level in that particular industry, whether or not somebody can really make a living at it, and with a family. You know, these are big issues. So how are we going to pay for it when we're asking the people that pay the taxes, who can't afford to make a living, we need more investment, we need more revenue. Where are we going to get the money?
Well, I'll take a stab at that, Representative Holvey, Chairman Witt. We're all in this together. I do not believe that we can ask the wage earner, quote unquote, to be paying any disproportionate share than what the business community is. But we are not going to solve this problem by necessarily decreasing business profits or decreasing the wage level so the business can be more profitable. I mean, we have to just recognize we are in this together, and that, to me, education is the one that creates the opportunity to have a higher wage job. We do not want to lower our wages so we can be competitive internationally.
Yeah.
You know, people have that theory. You can't. That is not going to work. So we have to take the reverse of that and saying that we create the opportunities for the jobs to have the wage earners that can pay the higher taxes because they have a higher wage. I don't know that there's any, you know, a simple answer to that. I just really believe that is the answer as we elevate the whole level of our state. You know, I will just take this opportunity to say that the business community at our association was here during the recession. And some of you were here and some of you weren't. And we were here down saying, we will pay our fair share of whatever it takes to get through this. And we even supported some additional taxes at that point, which I'm not saying the whole business community does that. But we're in this together, and I think we have to look at where we want to go, and it's education is the key. And that's probably not the definitive answer that you'd like, Representative Holwood, but I believe that's the truth.
I'd like to say something. There was a time when many employers, and still in my current policy manual, that the employers pay some portion of educational classes if an employee wants to go back. But, you know, mainly it has to relate to the job. For example, if it's technology, you don't pay for basket weaving. I think we need to encourage that some more with employers. I think working with employers to bring back some of those incentives and I don't know, maybe in the form of tax credit, you know, I'm not sure about that. So I think there are ways that where there is a time when employers and the community work together, and I think we need to look at that and bring some of that back. The other thing is I'd like to bring back some of your questions to the Governor's Small Business Council and help you find some solutions to this, because we are working with some of the Senate committees on small business issues. So, you know, I would like to, if you give me permission, to bring those questions back and see if we can help come up with either short-term or some viable solutions to answer that.
Yes, Duncan. First, in general, and I would focus on traded sector firms because, in general, their wages tend to be a little bit higher, but more importantly, they bring in fresh dollars, as you heard earlier, and that generates the revenue for public services and the broader community. I think that becomes really important. At the same time, I would focus on high-wage jobs in general. You know, I think that does support the state more effectively. The whole issue, which we haven't talked, Lynn alluded to it, and Christine, is the role of employers in paying for training. And I think that is the role of employers, individuals, and the public in terms of the mix for education and training is a critical policy issue. Among my members of Oregon Business Council, which are large companies, typically do have the kind of reimbursement for training that you might want. But of course, these are large companies and their employees tend to stay in the company, so they essentially internalize the value of that. If you're in a smaller company and you've trained a person and they leave, then you may have lost a lot of investments you simply can't afford. That is a policy issue I think we really need to grapple with, about how you create, in terms of adult education, a policy framework that works for raising skills and knowledge across the adult population. The group in the adult population that's getting the least support are the lowest income and those who really need this. And that's why I think the governor's put a program to deal with that, because, of course, employers have a hard time. You know, those are generalized skills that, again, can evaporate if the employee leaves. It's very, very hard to pay for. So there's a huge policy issue there that we haven't touched on, and I would encourage you to think more about as the session goes on.
Thank you all very, very much. And Representative Dahlem, his quote was that education, 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 it's the solution to every problem. Thank you all very much.
Thanks very much.
Including, Mr. Chair, educating us.
Including educating
Mr. Dahlem.
Our last and final person investing in Oregon's workforce is Tom Chamberlain from the Oregon AFL-CIO. The chair purposefully let the questioning go on in this last panel because both the questions and the answers, I think, were so terribly important. We have cut Mr. Chamberlain's time. And Tom, do you have another committee hearing right after this? Okay, the chair would ask that anyone who would be willing to stay a few minutes late to complete this, I'd ask for that courtesy. Those of you that have to leave for other meetings, I understand. Tom, if you'd please come forward. Good morning. Sorry for putting you on late here, but we're gonna hear what you have to tell us, Tom.
You know, I've been down here, Mr. Chair. I've been down at the legislature for a long time, and this isn't the first time I've been late with a testimony. So it goes with the territory. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for giving organized labor an opportunity to speak on this issue. You know, I grew up in a time when it was a proud thing to be a plumber or an electrician. In fact, when I was hired as a firefighter, my union father said, "Kid, you got it made for the rest of your life." And he was right. I had a great career. But I don't know if that's true today. I think the way the workforce is, it's much more challenging. And I believe that the AFL-CIO is in a position to assist in meeting that challenge. When I assumed the office 14 months ago, I had no concept to the multifaceted organization that the AFL-CIO is. We are very much involved in economic development. We're very much involved with workforce, and that is precisely why we have become the Apollo Alliance in the state of Oregon. And for those of you who don't know what the Apollo Alliance is, it's a coalition of labor, environmentalists, and business when we develop alternative fuels, alternative energies, that we're also creating family wage jobs. That's what the AFL is about, building the middle class through family wage jobs. We believe in workforce, high-performance manufacturing is rightfully the focus of the governor's workforce strategy. The creation and retention of family wage jobs in manufacturing is critical to the health of our economy and the well-being of our citizens. Right now, the AFL is engaged in trying to revitalize the apprenticeship program in manufacturing. At one time, 25, 30 years ago, there are many apprenticeship programs in manufacturing. We don't have them today. So currently we're partnering with Hua Chang to try to implement a manufacturing apprenticeship program. High-performance manufacturing and the workforce system in general require the ideas and participation of workers and their unions. These are the people who understand the work process most intimately and know what skills and training will best make the process effective and efficient. We deserve a place at the table when workforce issues are debated. And that isn't always the case. And registered apprenticeship programs are the key to meeting the workforce training challenge in the state, in contrast to a short-term training programs. Apprenticeships provides workers with a broad skill set, a critical recognition throughout the state, and a system that encourages their input through joint committee decision making. Another focus should be the way in which workers are compensated for securing additional training. Employers must be willing to pay workers more for investing their time to upgrade their skills. Family wages and a provision for health benefits should be encouraged by state policy. The economic development and workforce system must be accountable to Oregonians. This means that its impact should be assessed on a regular basis using basic criteria of the number of jobs created in manufacturing, medium wages paid, access to employer-paid benefits, and we should measure the extent to which our schools are preparing good students for well-paid blue-collar jobs as well as college. The Oregon AFL-CIO plays an important role in educating and activating its members to participate. It also coordinates labor's interaction with state agencies and the business community. Its goal is an economic climate in our state that considers the well-being of family wages equally and the economic success of private companies. We are committed to playing a proactive and constructive role in the current legislative session to reach that goal.
Thank you very much, Tom. Very much. Questions? Representative Bellum.
Tom, you're talking about reactivating an apprenticeship program that was popular in use 35 years ago. What does that look like on the ground? How does a person get into that program? Who pays? And when they come out, what's the end result?
Well, these are pilot programs. And the end result, we talked to Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Dolan, previously it was discussed that we have an aging workforce. That's very true in the manufacturing or the industrial sector. What we're trying to set up are pilot programs. So it would be company by company. At Hua Chang, it would be perhaps developing a criteria and an apprenticeship program within Hua Chang to train certain skill sets that will be needed in the future. How that might be rolled out statewide or to different industries, we're not to that point yet.
Thank you.
Other questions and comments? There are, Tom, I know there have been a number of apprenticeships in a whole lot of industries that for one reason or another have kind of fallen by the wayside, not the least of which the folks that I represent in the retail food industry used to be a very aggressive apprenticeship program for meat cutters. It's moved more towards on-the-job training right now, and quite frankly, there are a lot of skills that I think folks would benefit from if we resorted back to the traditional apprenticeship type program. And if this is an example of only one industry in retail, and I you've mentioned Hua Chang in manufacturing. I suspect that there is a great potential for this to occur in a number of industries. One of the things that we heard in one of the committee's earlier meetings, it was a couple of meetings ago, I believe, that it's not atypical anymore for students, folks that have gone beyond school, to, in essence, try and find a career up to age 30, I think was what we were talking about in that meeting. This contrasts markedly with what we see with a lot of our global competitors,
where kids have a profession, a career, oftentimes which is founded is based upon an apprenticeship earlier on in their life, and they are in the workforce and in a productive lifetime career up to a decade earlier than may be typical of what's happening here in the United States. Just wondering if you would comment on some of that.
Absolutely. Chair Witt, members of the committee, I think Representative Holvey hit on one of the problems, and that's been the disinvestment in our professional and technical training at the high schools. I think there's an opportunity with the building trades apprenticeship programs in particular to develop some type of either using their facilities or regional facilities where students who are interested in an apprentice, and I'm using the building trades because they're up and running, to get into those high schools early, get those folks into shop, get them engaged in that type of work, and begin the training process early. That was going to be one of my recommendations to you, is move forward with that. And that is just an example, but you could take that across different industries. I mean, what we have in high schools today is pretty much a disconnect between what's happening in the workforce, what's available out there, what salaries are paid, and what's happening within the high school. I mean, there's this push that every student is going to go to college, and it's just not true. Just not true. And the truth is that when you look at the data, the demand for college graduate matches the number of kids completing college. So we're not going to change that. What we can change are opportunities for the kids in schools, more direct ties to apprenticeship programs throughout different industries. The other thing I'd ask you to look at is every system needs checks and balances. Every system. And internal checks don't tend to work. I mean, an auditor makes their living by doing external checks on your accounts and balances, your bookkeeping. I would dare say the same is true for workforce. Where's the checks and balances? Where's the outside evaluation of where our dollars are going, if it's being best spent? I think what we do in this state is commendable, and the people who work on workforce development are some of the best in the country. But I dare say that an internal audit from time to time is warranted.
Thank you very much. Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Mr. Chamberlain, earlier I made reference to, you know, one of the big workforce issues that I see is trying to attract a skilled workforce, and we can invest and get people trained up, and, you know, that's clearly where we need to go. But, you know, fundamentally, sometimes I think at the early ages, I think a lot of students or kids, you know, they're looking at it a career path, and do you see it sort of as an issue or as a problem if a particular industry doesn't have such a great wage level or an annual income? Oregon still struggles with, you know, a below average annual income for Oregonians, and so although I know not all jobs, not all industries are going to pay high wages all the time, you know, it seems like people make choices to be directed towards higher wage jobs. And so how do we address those industries that predominantly haven't really, their wage levels haven't come up because they're competing in a global economy, and so the industries struggle to remain profitable, and so trying to push those wage levels up so they can attract workers. How do we address that?
Chair Witt, Representative Holvey, I think one of the ways you can address that is target where your workforce dollars are going. Do you really want your workforce dollars to go to the creation of low-wage jobs? Or do you want to dedicate your workforce dollars to the creation and retention of family wage jobs? That's where I would focus.
Tom, I want to thank you very, very much for your testimony today, and particularly addressing what is customarily considered the blue and increasingly the gray-collar workforce and the potential workforce development that lies within those types of jobs. It's critically important, and I think we heard earlier that it's going to take a cultural change here in our country probably before we can fully take advantage of the opportunities that lie within these careers. Again, thank you so very, very much. I appreciate your patience. We made you late. I appreciate the patience of the entire committee. Ellen, if just briefly, could you let the audience know what we're going to be looking at next time?
Yes, thank you, Chair Witt. On Wednesday, January 24th at 8 a.m., we'll begin by hearing from Associated Oregon Industries about linking workforce and economic development. And then as a little bit more tantalizing, a surprise panel you'll be hearing from about concepts in workforce development, applied concepts, and that will be a panel of CEOs from some of Oregon's most exciting industries.
With that, I want to thank everyone for your very excellent testimony and your patience. So we stand adjourned until Wednesday.